I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We begin today with Senator Chris Van Hollen, who joins me from Washington with reaction to President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. Then a conversation with the acclaimed novelist Madison Smart Bell, best known for his three-part trilogy about Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian slave uprising of the late 18th century. Bell calls his latest novel a fever dream. It explores the complexity of family, the immigrant experience, and the power and possibility of the spirit world. It's called Behind the Moon, and we'll talk to the award-winning writer behind this captivating novel. Madison Smart Bell and Viewing the World Through the Prism of Fiction. That's coming up right after a conversation with Senator Chris Van Hollen on Midday. First, the news. And welcome back to Midday. We're going to turn now to the novelist Madison Smart Bell. He is the author of more than 20 books, which includes novels, short stories, and works of nonfiction. In 1995 and 1996, his novel All Souls Rising was a finalist for the National Book Award and then the Penn Faulkner Award. It won the Annisfield Wolf Award for the best book of the year dealing with matters of race. It's the first of a three-part trilogy about Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian slave uprising in the late 18th century. Madison Bell is a professor of English and the co-director of the Kratz Center for Creative Writing at Goucher College. He calls his latest novel a fever dream. It begins with a group of teenagers skipping school and heading to the desert for a camping trip. When one of them gets into an accident, it sets off a chain of events that brings together an absent mother, a young refugee, and a shaman, among others, for a story that delves into the complexities of family, the hardships of the outsider, and the power and possibility of the spirit world. It's called Behind the Moon. Madison Smart Bell will be speaking about his new book Saturday night at the bookstore and coffee shop Bird in Hand in Charles Village. And today he joins me in the studio. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
Thanks for coming by. You are welcome to join our conversation with Madison Smart Bell. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, which we certainly hope you will do, @MiddayTomHall. So, Madison, we've had plans to have this conversation about your book for a number of weeks. And congratulations on the book, by the way. It's a terrific read.
And good looking, too.
Yeah, it is a good looking book, and we can talk a little bit about that. But, of course, news events, of which there have been many, not just this week, not just yesterday with the firing of James Comey, but really ever since the campaign, which was just so, rife with stuff happening, incidents day in and day out. It's interesting. How does fiction, do you think? I mean, as a fiction writer, when you place the world or view the world through the prism of stories that you've concocted, how do you feel it relates? I mean, what are the ways in which it's relevant to our thinking about what's going on in the world?
Well, I could start by saying that American political life has actually itself become a fever dream. Best I can figure. And as far as the function of fiction in public life, well, to paraphrase Captain Beefheart, everybody's doing it and they've already ruined it. If you want to parse the news of the day, I think the question that you asked the senator about Trump's claim in his letter to Comey that Comey had told him three times that he was not under investigation. It's just a classic example. Well, an example. It resembles in many cases when Trump would, on the wing, invent stuff for short-term purposes. This is certainly part of the art of fiction, but I'm not sure I'm happy to see it deployed in this way. On a slightly larger plan, and here I will make a comparison. This book is a recent review, really, really kind of brilliant review in a tiny little magazine online called Numero 5 by Linda Chown. Has a lot of wise things to say about it, but one of the things she points out, and she presents this as a positive is that there is no story. And I thought, oh, I didn't really understand that until I read the review. But there, what there is a lot of alternative versions of events that, and they all have kind of equal status. Well, thanks to Karl Rove, and thank you very much, Karl. We are now living in a world like that in which all news is fake news. The reality-based world has no validity for about half the population and half the electorate.
So and you date that to Karl Rove and the Bush administration rather than Mr. Bannon and the Trump administration.
Oh, no, it was explicitly a Karl Rove idea. He said, this is not going to be an exact quote, but this was something he was saying to journalists during the Bush administration, was the problem with you guys is that you're still trying to live in a reality-based world. So I think
the Trump
elaboration of that idea is more flamboyant than I think even people like Rove might have anticipated. But the amazing and really disturbing thing is that it continues to work. I mean, the comparisons to Nixon that are coming out now, I think, are.
And then the Saturday Night Massacre in particular.
One thing I'm thinking about that is that, in fact, Nixon was compared to Trump as sort of petty criminal. I mean, he was the fall of his administration came out of the Dirty Tricks campaign, which was petty crime, basically, and the effort to cover it up, which was what proved to be fatal. If they just, you know, fallen on their swords over those burglaries, and, you know, they would have survived. But Trump, by comparison, is really a tyrant and is presenting an existential threat to the American political system, which is already in kind of shaky state. And firing Comey should be a fatal mistake. But we just don't know if it will be, because we don't know how it's going to be received. I mean, I heard about this from you, because I don't start my day with the news. So I was like buzzing Washington Post, New York Times stories, you know, not while driving, because that's not a good idea, but almost. And one of the things I'm thinking is, you know, what's the only thing we have left practically is free press. The problem is, not enough people listen. There's such a balkanization of opinion that these stories are coming out. I know where I can see my opinion of this event reflected, but everybody on the alt-right knows where they can see their opinion of this event reflected. So that, you know, I'm not sure what does it take to break through that situation.
Well, you know, you're not the first person to call the president a tyrant, certainly. But, you know, I read, for example, the Wall Street Journal's coverage of what happened last night. And I do think that it's an assessment and a summary of the events of the last 24 hours that anybody can point to as valid, accurate, and thorough. Now, the editorial page supports the president's decision to get rid of Mr. Comey, and I think in a lot of ways the Democrats are going to have a difficult time making the case that Mr. Comey's behavior in office was in fact justifiable, because for so many months they made the case that it wasn't. I mean, you read Rosenstein's memo, and that memo really does look like it could have been written by somebody at the Democratic National Committee. It's something that the Clinton campaign, the same points that the Clinton campaign were making in the summer and in the fall, particularly at the 11th hour when he made another statement about the Huma Abedin emails. I mean, I think this is a very different thing personally than, for example, the Saturday Night Massacre, where, as you say, the level of villainy was a very different level. Defending Comey for the way he handled the investigation and the public statements he made about the Clinton emails is not an easy thing to do.
No, but I think the senator who just left us was absolutely convincing about the timing. If this president had desired to act on Comey's misbehavior that was to his advantage, he should have done it when he walked in the door. And he did many things that he wanted to do very rapidly when he walked in the door. If that was on his agenda, he would have done it then. That's not the reason. There's no way.
And, of course, the president has flip-flopped 1,000 times about whether he thinks Comey's a good guy or a bad guy, depending on what Comey had said on any particular day. One of the things that always fascinates me about your work, I mean, you've written about so many different kinds of characters, from Confederate generals to, psychologists to, in this book, a bunch of teenagers and a mother. Behind the Moon, your latest novel. When you are imagining how a person is feeling, when you are imagining the interior life of these people who aren't you, I wonder, does that can you lend us any insight as you imagine the mindset and the interior monologues going on for the many millions of people who voted for Mr. Trump and who to this day don't think he's done anything wrong and who are quite satisfied in large measure with Mr. Trump's capacity to deliver on the exact promises that he made during the campaign?
Yeah, that's a fascinating and frustrating subject. And I think this is something as a fiction writer, what I habitually do, I'm going to tackle the front end of your question first because it's a kind of craft point. But I'm going to appeal to the way people's dreams generally are, but then I have been told from time to time that my dreams aren't like other people's dreams. But my dreams, and I think many people's dreams, involve you inhabiting many different characters in the dream, often simultaneously, which is weird. But your mind is perfectly happy doing that in a dream. So in composing a cast of characters, in order to make them credible to me, which is the first thing that has to happen, I just sort of dream myself into their identities. That's what I do technically. One of the first things that became apparent to me when the day after the election, really, and for the past few years, I've attended Quaker meeting at Stony Run pretty regularly, and this is a big topic there too. That was a community that was pretty thoroughly crushed by the outcome, and but also one which very soon began to say we have to not lose our empathy for the people who voted this into being, because the whole problem is that we have no rapport with them and don't understand them, and they feel the same way about us. So we have to somehow dream our way into their thinking, and so in order to get some sense of their motives. And I think, one of the things. So I wrote a review of a book by Omar El-Akkad called American War, which is about a civil war taking place in the United States about 70 years from now. And it's not predicated on the politics of today. Well, it's written before, for one thing, but we've had,
But this is an apocalyptic novel about.
It's a dystopian apocalyptic novel, and it doesn't relate very much to the politics of the last 20 years. But one of the things that I said in the review was, it crystallized something for me, is that we sort of understood that the people who voted for Trump during the Obama administration felt that the country had been stolen from them, and then were in a state of rage and despair. But I don't think you really get that until the bottom rail's put up below on top, and you're the person who feels like the country's been stolen from you, and the rage and despair become your own.
Yeah, dream your way into their thinking. I like that. 410-662-8780. That's our number here on Midday to talk with the novelist Madison Smart Bell. You want to drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So for folks who haven't read the book, and it's brand new, so that's probably most folks listening to us now, tell us a little bit about some of the characters. Let's start with Julie and Jamal, two really interesting young people.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of teenagers. Julie, in a way, is barely present as a character because she's unconscious for most of it. I mean, she's this teenage girl playing hooky with her girlfriend, and she's kind of interested in this guy Jamal, but you know, in this very innocent way. And the other two guys that are on the party are older and have more sinister intentions that she doesn't know about. So she's sort of sacred innocent. And then she's either in a coma or in this some kind of prehistoric world for most of the rest of the story. Jamal, boy, I wish somebody could tell me where that character came from. I just saw his name on I saw these paragraphs on a page that I don't have any other, I have no real recollection of making this guy up. He's some dream figment or whatever, but the way the story evolves, you have to figure that he and his family are survivors of some kind of Middle Eastern conflict that kind of resembles the Intifada, and have come to a place which in the beginning I wasn't going to specify at all. In the first movement of the book, there's no indication of where it is or if it's a real place. I mean, you can tell it's in the United States, but that's about it. But then in other parts of the book involving other characters, it gradually turned into South Dakota. So what people like that would be doing there is, I don't know. And then there's some of the bad guys are Serbian. So, whatever. It's an international story.
I happen to read, it is indeed. And it's a fun read. I happen to read it the same week I read the new book by George Saunders, Lincoln in the Bardo. So I read your book first, and I loved it, and I read George's book and loved that as well. And it was fascinating to me. George writes about ghosts and Lincoln visiting the corpse of his dead son, Willie, and it sort of takes off from there. And there's a whole character of people who are not just invented in the way authors invent fictional characters, but they aren't corporeal. And so much of the, or a good bit of this book takes place in this dream state or whatever. You should tell us, you should describe, you call the book a fever dream, but it takes place inside the mind of Julie, who's been in an accident and is, as you say, in a coma or sort of out of commission for most of the book. Writing that kind of state, that kind of character, seems to me to be a really tall order. I mean, in terms of craft, that it's much harder to write that sort of scenario than it is to write a flesh and blood person who's doing stuff and interacting with other people.
Well, I did find it difficult. Part of the inspiration for the book was an article by Judith Thurman in the New Yorker about the Chauvet Caves, which are the ones that Werner Herzog made the film, 3D film, Cave of Forgotten Dreams about. I had already written a version of this book when the movie came out, and I went to see the 3D version in New York, and very excited to see it. I was, from the first 5 minutes, so totally hypnotized that I remembered nothing. There's a moment when he's flying the drones around outside of the cave that I remember. That's like, it was a really weird experience. But one of my motives was to try to get at the origins of religion for prehistoric human beings, and which is very difficult to reach by any conventional means because, you can't talk to them. There's, you can't send your anthropologist.
The origins of religion prehistoric
human beings. Because that was what the Thurman article was about. Mm-hmm. She referred a lot to...
Because these are very old caves.
These are very old caves, but there were some scholars who wrote a book called The Shamans of Prehistory who have an interpretation of religious significance of the, not those paintings because they had, but other ones, the Lascaux stuff and whatnot, and which is persuasive, but also, speculative. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that in fiction. Maybe I could make that happen somehow in fiction. But then I ran out, if I tried to, I was wanting to create a kind of literalized prehistoric world, and so there's a point where the real life landscape kind of turns into the badlands of South Dakota, and that is an area that in prehistoric times was kind of sort of lake country, and so I did that maneuver, but peopling it was just very, very difficult. I kept moving in that direction, thinking, nope, I'm going to end up writing Clan of the Cave Bear. That's not what I want. So it just became, it remained very kind of dreamlike, surreal, indefinite.
You write with great facility. You write quickly.
I do.
I mean, we've known each other for a long time.
I don't like it to hurt either.
Yeah, yeah. So what is that like? I mean, and I wonder, like, with these dream sequences, which of the book of the dream sequences and the or, and I keep calling them dream sequences, but whatever. Maybe
I think that's a fair thing to call them. I mean, the really the point of the book. I understood this better. I always kind of knew this, but reading this review of it made it more clear to me. Is that all the parts of it have equal claim to validity, like the weird and crazy ones that seem abnormal actually do have. And that keeps, I mean, I did that, not consciously perhaps, but deliberately, because they're the first and last movements of the book have alternative versions of the same sequence of event arranged side by side. And that, you know, my instincts just told me to do that.
Because I do find, and I've read a lot of your work, and we've talked about it over the years because we have known each other for so long, that those sequences were harder for me to comprehend. They were harder. They were a deeper dig for me to understand as a reader, as opposed to the stuff that was happening with the awake characters. I wonder, when you're writing it, I mean, you talk about how it was a challenge for you as a writer who does write, you know, in a very facile way. Are you conscious, and what are you considering your responsibility and your obligation to the reader in terms of her capacity to understand it quickly?
Well, those passages are confusing for one thing. They're hard to grasp. So one of my friendly gestures to the reader is to not leave the reader trapped in them for too long.
Because
I mean, as a practical matter, if reader becomes irritated with that experience, they're apt to pull the ripcord and just, you know, punch out of the story. So there are regular returns to scenes that at least appear to be grounded in reality. But one of the things I realized about my intentions, like ex post facto, is that I'm not trying to describe this kind of psychologically dislocating experience. I'm actually trying to make it happen to the reader. Yeah. And once I understood that, I thought, oh, now I know why I did all this stuff, including the pages with the peculiar visuals on them.
Right, because that's another thing. There's a graphic element to this novel. There are there's like hieroglyphics hieroglyphics.
There are these pages. They were really brilliantly designed by the publisher. They actually used my artwork I had done that break out the page stops looking like a page, and there's words floating around amidst this other stuff, and it all looks sort of 3D in a weird way, and which relates to a couple of things, visual phenomena that happen on a stage of a shamanic journey, and some specific descriptions of Golok's hat type stuff that I maybe shouldn't go into right now.
Well, it's fun stuff that you know, there's a visual experience in addition to the literary experience. And we will talk more about this with Madison Smart Bell. The new novel is called Behind the Moon. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. You can join our conversation if you'd like at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back after a quick break. Please stick around.
This is your public radio member supported 88.1 WYPR. Box of skulls, the hats you wore last week.
And welcome back. It's Midday. That's Music by Madison Smart Bellies, my guest today. The album he did with Wynn Cooper that was in conjunction with one of his previous novels called Anything Goes. I'm speaking with Madison Smart Bell today about his newest novel, Behind the Moon. By the way, coming up tomorrow on Midday, it's our monthly installment of Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere. Tomorrow, a look at the state of religious freedom and tolerance in America, 100-plus days into the Trump administration. Guest host Rob Sivak will speak with John Gehring. He's the Catholic Program Director at Faith in Public Life. Imam Bashar Arafat is the president of the Islamic Affairs Council of Maryland, and Rabbi Daniel Berg, who is the rabbi at Beth Am Synagogue. We'll have a theater review as well with J. Wynn Russick. Tomorrow, Judy's going to give us her take on the Fantastics at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. So I hope you can join us tomorrow for the Thursday edition of Midday. As I just mentioned, if you're just joining us, my guest today is the novelist Madison Smart Bell. The latest novel from this very prolific and acclaimed writer is called Behind the Moon. He's the author of many other novels, including a trilogy of books about Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian slave revolt. The first of those books, All Souls Rising, was a finalist for the National Book Award and Penn Faulkner Award. He's a professor of English, the chair for distinguished achievement, and the co-director of the Kratz Center for Creative Writing at Goucher College. He's going to talk about his new novel, Saturday Night at Bird in Hand. That's a bookstore and coffee shop on 33rd Street in Charles Village here in Baltimore. If you'd like to speak with Madison Smart Bell, 410-662-8780 is the phone number. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go to the phones. This is Carol from Towson. Welcome to Midday with Madison Smart Bell.
Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Bell, I was really struck by your statement about rage and despair and how we're having to move from being in a position of trying to understand how the people who voted for Trump may be feeling rage and despair, and maybe that's why, to now we, many of us, are feeling rage and despair. And what do you see as the next step? How should we respond to that? What should we do?
Well, I just it's difficult to say how you accomplish it. We have to, the two halves of the country have got to figure out a way to start talking to each other, so that they can understand who each other are. Because what, you know, what people want the country to be is not as, you know, vastly different on the two, you know, in the red states and the blue states, and as we're inclined to think. People want some kind of social security, economic security. Everybody wants this. Everybody wants a health system that works in their favor. People want peace if they can have it. And everybody wants a growth economy so that they can, so that they and their children can improve their lives. These are shared goals, and somehow we can't, you know, we can't see what we share. We are only able to see the things that drive us apart.
I mean, Carol, do you see a possibility of yourself Carol's not here anymore. I just wondered if she or any other listeners, you know, can imagine themselves, as Madison says, dreaming their way into understanding another person. Because I think, you know, Madison, you can make the point that perhaps it's not really a matter of understanding. I mean, I think folks on the left understand where people on the right are coming from. I think it's a matter of persuasion. I talked to two reporters who wrote a book about the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, which they put in the title, The Doomed Campaign of Hillary Clinton. And they made a conscious decision strategically not to try to persuade Trump voters to vote for Secretary Clinton. They said, we're going to basically concentrate on the people who already support us, on the theory that there are more people who support the agenda of Secretary Clinton than there were that supported the agenda of Mr. Trump. So we're not going to even try to persuade a Trump voter why he or she shouldn't vote for Mr. Trump and vote for Secretary Clinton instead. I mean, I think persuasion is a difficult thing to do once you encounter a person who's set in her ways. But, you know, people on the left are just as set in their ways as people on the right in most instances.
Well, okay, understanding the behavior of a person the way you understand the behavior of a rat in a Skinner box is not the same as having a sympathetic sharing of that person's experience and their motivation. And that, I think, is what we need to reach. It's easy to have empathy for people who are like you. People who are like polar opposites to you, it's much more difficult. So that, I think, is the challenge. And with all of these, I mean, one of the things I think about Trump supporters who still support him, and there are plenty of those, in spite of the fact that he's not delivering for the working class, and you know, the college jobs are not going to come back. I mean, a lot of the stuff is simply not going to happen. Immigration is not going to be stopped in the way that he claimed, but they believe that they want a single strong man who can get things done, and that's what they see in him. I think they're kind of projecting on him, and he's like welcoming the projection. But then the classical meaning of the word tyrant is just that. Tyrant's not necessarily a bad thing. A tyrant is somebody you can get things done without a lot of red tape, which real democracy such as the Greeks had was fraught with complication. You had to listen to everybody. And so a tyrant can be an enlightened despot and a good thing in a way. So that, I think, we think we don't like that. I certainly personally don't want tyranny, even if it's benign. But I think a lot of the Trump people, yeah, that's what they thought they were voting for, and they still, many of them, believe that's what they got.
Madison Smart Bell, his new book is called Behind the Moon. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. You mentioned immigration. You write about the immigrant experience in this new novel, this family from some undisclosed Middle Eastern place. I mean, I thought it was Iraqi for a little while.
Well, it's not specified. I mean, you can just tell that the person you spend the most time with is this teenage kid, Jamal, and all you really know about his background is his mother runs a Middle Eastern restaurant, and he at some point in his life has spent some time running around throwing rocks at tanks. That's that.
Yeah. But it brought to mind a novel I read a few years ago by Tai Selassie called Ghana Must Go, and another one I read by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie called Americana, in which they talk about the immigrant experience and the experience in those two instances of Africa in a way that you don't often read about Africa. I mean, Africa, we tend to hear about civil war and strife and disorganization and extreme poverty. They're writing about people with professional lives, not unlike many people in our milieu. There is this anti-immigrant fervor in the United States that helped propel Mr. Trump to his current office. It seemed to propel Marine Le Pen at least close to the presidency of France.
Vive la France quand même, huh?
Yeah,
that's one place where the system seems to be working.
Yeah, your insights into the experience of Jamal, his mother, and then we also meet a couple of brothers of his. What are we? When you talk about dreaming your way into understanding somebody else, what are we not dreaming when it comes to the immigrant experience? What do we? What is lacking in our conversation about immigration?
Okay, a stupid cultural mistake was made about 20 years ago when we decided, and it started in the academy, as many things do. But this was an idea that unfortunately did not stay there. It got out of the box, and the idea was we're going to forget about the old immigrant goal of assimilation and instead talk about having identity politics that I'm going to use this ugly academic word, privileges the boundaries of other identities and wants to preserve them instead of having them blend into the so-called American melting pot. So the problem with that is once it's pushed for 20 years, and this was a factor in the campaign, people who consider themselves to be mainstream, then these are the people who live in the red states, otherwise known to people on the coast as the flyover area, start looking at those groups.
I'm sorry, the what area?
The flyover area.
Oh, the flyover, yeah.
You've surely heard that expression.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
It's not actually helping.
I've done it myself.
It
yeah.
So so they look at these groups who want to be separate, and they say, those people are actually saying that they are incorrigibly alien to us. And once you say that, it's like, okay, the other, they're dangerous. We need to get rid of them. And that whole thing was that was driving the election, and that the anti-immigration thing is driven by that too. I mean, behind all that is the fact that there are too many people on the planet. Very few people are willing to confront that directly. But if you look at what's happening in Europe right now, the overpopulated areas of the planet are starting to seriously leak into Western Europe, where things until recently were still, viable for a relatively small number of people. And I think, part of the fear of immigration is really just fundamentally, I mean, that's like the root fear. And it's real because we have no solution to it. I mean, no one is trying to think of a solution to it.
You spent a lot of time in France. You spent a lot of time in Haiti. Your book, All Souls Rising, won an award for its treatment of matters of race. You've thought a lot about race. We are now 2 years and 2 weeks past the anniversary of occurrence of the violence and uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray. Where do you think we stand as a city? Because you've written about Baltimore, you've lived here a long time, in terms of the racial conversation that we're having here locally.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know. What was the name of the prosecutor, Mosby?
Marilyn Mosby.
Marilyn
Mosby,
state's
attorney.
I think she's a very interesting figure, and
She was the one that announced the indictments of the six officers.
Right, and I looked
arrest.
At that at the time, and I thought, I know my father's a lawyer, so that gives you the worst kind of amateur legal opinions you can possibly imagine. Here comes one. I looked at her, and I think I know why she's doing this, because it's going to calm things down, but I'm afraid she's overcharging these cases, and they'll fail, which did happen. I don't know if my theory of why it happened is right, but I heard her on the radio. She might have been talking to you, as a matter of fact.
She does that occasionally.
Sent you an email about it. I'm not sure. I was in my car, so I didn't do it on the spot, but she pulled out the most magnificent piece of spin control that I've ever heard in my entire life, which was, yeah, we lost those cases, but we forced the Baltimore PD to reform itself, and they're doing that. And I thought, holy moly, not only is that just like brilliant rhetoric, but if it's true, it's actually a good thing. So I don't. You tell me. Is that true? If that's true, I think we're doing okay.
I think there's absolutely
doing better than we might have.
I think there's absolutely a case to be made that reforms have happened since the riots in 2015. That they were animated, at least to some extent, by the indictments and the DOJ report, the consent decree. I mean, it's a whole mix of things. I don't think Ms. Mosby can take sole credit for it, but I think, yeah, sure. I think there's an argument that could be made. Yeah. We are out of time. Always good to see you. Thanks very much. And the book is terrific. I really enjoyed reading it. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. And we didn't talk about it too much, but you can always read it and find out that way.
Yes, indeed. Madison Smart Bell, his new novel is called Behind the Moon. He's going to be talking about the book Saturday night at Bird in Hand Coffee Shop and Bookstore in Charles Village. It's part of their Starts Here reading series. That event begins at 7 o'clock Saturday night. And we've got a link to all the deets on our website, wypr.org/midday. That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, guest host Rob Sivak will preside over this month's installment of Living Questions. That's our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Tomorrow, Rob will have John Gehring from the Faith and Public Life Institute, Imam Bashar Arafat from the Islamic Affairs Council of Maryland, and Rabbi Daniel Berg of Beth Am Synagogue. We're going to talk about religion and religious freedom in these first 100-plus days of the Trump administration. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review The Fantastics at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden, offering a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening, they're offering a class in Sri Lankan cuisine, and on Friday, they'll give a class on vegetarian Indian cuisine. We'll have more on the web, baltimorechefshop.com. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Appreciate your joining us. Have a great day.